From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Members of President Trump's coronavirus task force testified today about the administration's response to the coronavirus. And Dr. Anthony Fauci said a vaccine will not be ready by the time college classes are scheduled to start in the fall.
The idea of having treatments available or a vaccine to facilitate the reentry of students into the fall term would be something that would be a bit of a bridge too far.
Joining us now is NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis, who's been following the hearing today. And Sue, Fauci has warned today of needless suffering and death if restrictions are lifted too early. What more did he say about that?
Well, I think part of his message, both to Congress and to the public, is that states are beginning to reopen. He noted many states are following the protocols. People are trying to do the right thing. But in the pressure to reopen, especially as schools and businesses consider it, that the risk is if too much happens too soon, we could see another spike in surge in hotspots all across the country. And part of his message is that one of the things that people need to be really mindful for is that the faster they reopen, they need to make sure that they have the type of critical healthcare crisis centers they would need in order to confront a potential wave of cases if that were to occur. I mean, he's always been given sort of sober assessments, not just to the president, but to the public. And I think it sort of tracks with his cautious approach from day one on how to be handling this pandemic going forward.
Now, Fauci was testifying via video link, as were other members of the administration, as were some lawmakers, including the ranking Democrat on the committee, Patty Murray, who called President Trump's response a disaster. Listen.
Delays, missteps have put us way behind where we need to be on diagnostic tests and allowed inaccurate antibody tests to flood the market. Corruption and political interference have impeded efforts to secure desperately needed personal protective equipment.
Did Fauci criticize President Trump's push to reopen states? Some states have begun opening without following the guidelines that Fauci helped draw up.
No. And he has never been a direct critic of the president. He's sometimes had to counter what the president is saying, but he did not criticize the president, nor did any of the public health officials testifying. If anything, people like Dr. Brett Giroir, who heads the U.S. Public Health Service, sort of gave testimony about the number of tests that aligned with the White House, saying that the U.S. has actually made great strides on testing, but that he also said that they are working to enhance testing to have as many as 30 to 50 million tests available each month by August. August or September. This is critical because Democrats and Republicans on the committee are equally concerned about the level of testing capacity, not how many tests are just out in the public, but how fast people can get the results. And that is, which is the one point here that everyone seems to agree on, that we can't get back to somewhat semblance of a normal life until if and when there's a vaccine, unless there is this kind of mass available rapid testing so you can get people back into their workplaces and back into their schools with some level of confidence.
Well, and unless there is some way to get kids off to school, because it's hard for parents to go to work if their kids are still at home. And I want to play another clip of tape here from Dr. Fauci. Republican Senator Rand Paul insisted that schools need to reopen in the fall and said Fauci wasn't the be-all and end-all of expert advice on reopening the economy. And here's Fauci's response.
First of all, Senator Paul, thank you for your comments. I have never made myself out to be the end-all and only voice in this. I'm a scientist, a physician, and a public health official. I give advice according to the best scientific evidence. There are a number of other people who come into that and give advice that are more related to the things that you spoke about the need to get the country back open again and economically. I don't give advice about economic things. I don't give advice about anything other than public health. So I wanted to respond to that.
He then went on, Sue, to say that, well, for the most part, children are not getting as sick as adults from coronavirus. There are some examples where they are getting quite sick. Fauci also acknowledged today that the death toll is likely higher than what's being reported. What did he say about that?
He did. He was asked that in a question from Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont, who was asked about the death toll. Currently, the official estimate is about 80,000, and he agreed that he believed that the estimate was likely much higher because some people, for example, may have died at home and their cause of death may not have been reported correctly. And that is counter to the message that the White House has been suggesting and many on the right suggesting that it might be lower. And he said, no, that's not true. He actually believes it's higher.
Sue Davis, NPR congressional correspondent, on just an extraordinary hearing today with so many people participating in the hearing by video link. Sue Davis, thank you.
You're welcome.
Members of the Western States Pact, that's Oregon, Washington, Nevada, and California, have joined together this week to ask the federal government for $1 trillion to help deal with the financial impact of the coronavirus. California, which has the world's fifth largest economy, is now dealing with a $54 billion deficit and 18% unemployment. Tom Steyer, former Democratic presidential candidate and current co-chair of the California Task Force on Business Job Recovery, says in addition to money, the state needs to follow the lead of public health officials to get the economy up and running. And Tom Steyer joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Tanya, it's great to talk to you.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, you're leading up what is an 80-person task force, which includes Apple CEO Tim Cook and four former governors. You all have started meeting. How do you begin to take on such a massive undertaking, and what are you prioritizing?
With so many people and such a massive issue, it's really important to break it down into smaller subsectors that you can control. So we have 10 subcommittees. And I'd like to also say that in addition to the famous business leaders and former governors who are on this task force, we also have union leaders. We also have community activists. So that, in fact, in terms of what we're trying to do, which is to advise the governor about how to reopen as fast as safely possible in a just, green, and forward-looking way, we have people from across the state geographically, but also from the different intellectual and leadership parts of the state to make sure that it's not just helping big business, that, in fact, this is going to go to the people of California, that we are going to be taking into account. We're going to avoid that mistake which happened in 2008, 2009 with the Great Recession, where in fact it seemed as if all of the recovery served the purposes of the richest Americans and really didn't go directly to working people and to the people who were bearing the brunt of that recession and who were bearing the brunt of this pandemic and economic freefall.
You use the word green, and I want to ask you more about that. So your background is in business. You made your fortune as the founder of a hedge fund, but you've spent the last few years really making a case for a green economy. Do you see green jobs as an option in restabilizing California's economy?
Well, let me say this. I am, as the head of this task force, I am fighting for every person in California and every job. But we're also, in the longer term, we're talking about how do we invest to create that better California. We're not going back to January of 2020. We want to do something better than that. We want to have a more just, a more sustainable, a more forward-looking California so that we go through this very, very difficult and painful time and come out with something better. And so that includes sustainable energy, because that's the future.
There's been a little criticism that you may be too partisan of a choice for this task force, given that you've spent millions running for president and you were calling, very vocally calling, for President Trump's impeachment. What do you say to this criticism?
I would say this. In a time of crisis like this, and this is a health crisis and an economic crisis, there's no place for partisanship. And I can tell you, I have absolutely no interest in pursuing this as the co-head of this task force. There is no time for any kind of partisanship or separation between the federal government and the state government, between Democrats and Republicans, when the lives and the livelihoods of Californians are at stake.
I know you guys are just getting started, but as I mentioned, California has an 18% unemployment rate. Governor Newsom has said this economic turndown will be longer than a lot of us expect and, of course, want to, despite some economists arguing that it could right itself more quickly. Where do you stand on this? And really, what is the first step that the task force is taking in really tackling this major issue of people being out of work?
The first thing to understand, Tanya, is nobody knows. We can't know the timing on having cheap, ubiquitous testing. We can't know the timing on having a therapeutic response that makes everybody safe. But for this economy to work, and this just makes sense when you think about it, people need to feel safe. You're not going to go shopping if you don't think it's safe. You're not going to go to work if you don't think it's safe. It's really important for us not only to do the good job and live up to the governor's requirement that we take care of health first, but also that Californians understand that that's how it's being done and that they are safe. And I think everybody from working people to business owners understand that for us to rejuvenate this economy, to get the kind of recovery in jobs and business that we all want, we're going to have to make sure that health dictates are not only satisfied, but that people know they're satisfied and they feel comfortable again.
That's Tom Steyer, founder of NextGen and co-chair of the California Task Force on Business and Job Recovery. Thank you so much.
Pleasure to talk to you again.
There's a new book out today about Ted Turner and the founding of CNN. The network started in 1980 and quickly showed its value in covering news events as they were happening.
Again, briefly, shots rang out as President Reagan left the Washington Hilton Hotel this afternoon, shortly after the speech you saw him deliver live here in the cable news network. We are told
the launch of CNN by the eccentric and sometimes outrageous Turner ushered in a new era of nonstop news. Turner shared his vision for the network in his launch speech in June 1980 in front of CNN's Atlanta headquarters.
We hope that the cable news network, with its international coverage and greater depth coverage, will bring both in the country and in the world a better understanding of how people from different nations live and work together, and within the nation work together, so that we can perhaps, hopefully, bring together in brotherhood and kindness and friendship and in peace the people of this nation and this world.
Author Lisa Napoli's new book is called Up All Night, Ted Turner, CNN, and the Birth of 24-Hour News, and she joins me now. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Jeremy.
Well, and let's go back to the beginning for Ted Turner, who's not involved in CNN anymore, but when you look at where this all started, he was the child of a billboard salesman.
Yes, he owned a billboard company left to him by his father, who'd built it up bit by bit. And he could have gone on with that thread for the rest of his life, but it wasn't sexy enough for him. So he got into radio, and that led him ultimately into television.
To television, and in his case, it was a station that he acquired called WTCG in Atlanta, which was not a news station at all, even after he took it over.
It couldn't have been further from a news station. It was just a little scrappy UHF station. It didn't have a terribly great signal at the time, nor did it have great programming. It wasn't a network affiliate, so it didn't have that ready-made stable of programs. So basically what Ted did with that station, more than anything else, was decide something that no one had done before, which is to stay on all night. At the same time, his staff needed to fill the FCC requirement to do a certain amount of public service broadcasting. News is what it was at most other stations, but they didn't have the wherewithal or the interest in doing real news. So basically what they did was they did a jokey news that made the first television star on UHF, Bill Tush. But basically that's how he first got into television and first got into news.
Well, and the interesting thing was that he also had a very low opinion of television news in general.
He didn't like the news, and his staff wasn't so keen on producing the news either, but it was an obligation that they had to produce it. And they did it in the middle of the night, someplace where they figured, you know, it would just get lost in the shuffle. But what they didn't bargain for is that there were tons of insomniacs. And what they really didn't bargain for was that when they went up on cable and then up on the satellite and they could be seen at different time zones all around the country, lots of people were watching at all hours.
Well, and how did he go from this rinky-dink Atlanta station on UHF to CNN?
Well, Ted saw the power of television. He saw the power of cable television, and cable television delivered via satellite. And all those things made him start wondering what else could he do besides deliver TCG. Now, just to go back, I mean, it was remarkable at the time what he was doing by putting an Atlanta television station up on the bird, so to speak, on the satellite, so that people could receive it all around the country. That seeded the idea. What could he do next? And that was where he fell into news.
How important was it to CNN's success that it wasn't built in New York City, where the major television networks were based, but in Atlanta? Did it change what CNN brought to the nation, the fact that they were kind of outside the bubble?
I think perhaps, but more so what was happening at that moment in time, at the very beginning, the idea that news was coming in from all over and that CNN was creating something that seems so obvious right now, which was a network of affiliates all around the country that fed news into them. The networks, of course, the traditional broadcast networks were doing that. They were grabbing stories as things happened around the country. But CNN, that was their mainstay, was this network that they created of stations. That, of course, just the idea of a diversity of opinions would change everything.
You know, one thing that really surprised me in this book is that CNN turned down the opportunity to have its nightly talk show hosted by Oprah Winfrey before she was big.
Yes. There were a lot of people who were near Mrs. Charlie Rose was another. And instead, the big job went to a woman named Sandy Freeman, who was given this plum assignment that later Larry King took over. Mm-hmm. So it's so interesting to look at the early roots, because there are a lot of people who people may remember from the earliest days and they haven't thought about in years.
How good a businessman was Ted Turner? Because throughout your book, he seems to always be on the verge of running out of money every time he decides to take a risk.
Well, yes, he was a risk taker. And that was probably, if you think a good business person is somebody who takes risks, that's Ted Turner for sure. In that he also made a lot of decisions without money. I mean, for instance, launching CNN, the networks have thought about doing 24-hour news, but they didn't have the money or the wherewithal, and he didn't really care. He did it anyway. So yes, he, and famously, he wound up losing control of his empire because he took many risks, but he just didn't take no for an answer. In fact, if somebody said no, he would do it anyway, whether or not he had the money, like when he first got into television.
Well, and as we look today at the legacy of Ted Turner, and it's right in the title of your book there, The Birth of 24-Hour News, a lot of people would look at that and say, well, that's terrible. Now we have this 24-hour news cycle. Nobody can pay attention to the big picture anymore. Do you think that he really was the one who gave birth to 24-hour news in the world that we live in today as a result?
24-hour news was going to happen. Somebody was going to figure out that they needed to do this. Ted Turner and the people he employed and amassed did it first, and it's changed news forever. And of course, all of that was before the internet came and escalated it to the next level. So the conversation about how it's changed how news is delivered, I think about it every single day during the pandemic. What if I could just turn on the news at 6 o'clock and hear a very sober, measured, deliberate newscast that told me what happened that day? How would that change how everybody was relating to this pandemic? Mm-hmm. We'll never know, because you can't dial back the time. But what I loved about writing this book, as somebody who spent her career in the media, is that it makes you think about the fact that there was a time not very long ago when news wasn't instantly available. So it's not passing a judgment, and it's not a Fox versus CNN versus MSNBC thing. It really is the birth of 24-hour news and what was going on in our world at that moment in time that allowed it to happen.
Where's Ted Turner now? He's still alive, but we haven't heard from him in a long time.
Yes, he has come out publicly and said that he has a form of dementia called Lewy body. You know, his family is active with his environmental philanthropies and his environmental work. And his staff were very helpful and gracious to me as I looked for archival information, because a lot of it wasn't easy to find. And this is an unauthorized book. CNN didn't commission it or sanction it. So there were certain videotapes and recordings that I was looking for that his office was helpful to me with.
Now, the logo of CNN is still the same one that Ted Turner, according to your book, spent, what, $5,000 to purchase? Which is kind of amazing.
Yes, it's a great American business story. Basically, he commissioned the logo. Poor Reese Schoenfeld, the president, was scrambling around trying to get out of his last job. And behind his back, Ted commissioned this logo. Apparently, he didn't pay the whole $5,000, too. And it's two cables braided together. So talk about outdated. And that's another interesting part of this story, because all of the people who came to CNN in the early days were fighting the phone company, because the phone company was basically the carrier of all information, not just calls. Ironically, the phone company now owns CNN, AT&T.
But other than the logo, do you think that there's still some of Ted Turner in CNN?
Unfortunately, I think if you talk to a lot of the CNN originals, they would say no. I think that another reason I wrote this book is hopefully people will remember this pioneer and the people who worked with him and reflect on the contributions that they made in making it possible. But yes, if you look at the first hours of CNN, or if you remember them, it's nothing like what you see today. Part of that is because the computer graphics are a lot different, and the whole ethos is completely different, too.
That is Lisa Napoli, whose new book is called Up All Night, Ted Turner, CNN, and the Birth of 24-Hour News. Lisa, I really enjoyed this. I enjoyed it so much that I was fine reading it on a PDF because they, thanks to COVID-19, they couldn't even send the book to my house. But thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Introducing the Cable News Network.
The news 24 hours every day.
The Cable News Network, anchored in Atlanta, Washington.
Last week, House and Senate.
New York, with national bureaus in Los Angeles, Chicago, San Francisco.
And we've got an excerpt from the book at hereandnow.org. As the economic fallout from COVID-19 continues to worsen, many countries are extending their financial support for workers and industries. In the UK, for example, the Chancellor said today that the government will continue to pay furloughed worker salaries up to 80% through October. Here in the US, we're still waiting to find out if more government support is coming, and if so, what it will look like. But the politics are not turning out to be all that predictable. As St. Louis Public Radio's Jason Rosenbaum reports, Missouri Senator Josh Hawley, a conservative Republican, has a plan that would dramatically increase the federal government's role in solving the employment crisis.
Here's how Hawley's plan would work. Companies affected by COVID-19 could have the federal government cover a big chunk of employees' income, which Hawley says could be up to $50,000 per employee. Hawley says the idea, which many European countries are using to deal with the economic fallout from COVID-19, delivers certainty for employees and employers.
People are getting stir crazy. They want to go back to work, but they're also willing to do their part to break the back of this health epidemic. People being able to say, you know what, even if I am told I cannot physically go to work, I may not like that, but if I know I'm going to have my job, then, you know, that makes a little difference.
While not as generous, Hawley's plan is in line with what a number of Democrats have also proposed. It's not the first time that Hawley, who was elected to the Senate in 2018 on a socially conservative platform, has broken ranks with the GOP on economic policy. For example, the former Missouri Attorney General has also set his sights on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter, saying the tech companies are too big and powerful.
I'm all for the free market, but the free market depends on free and fair competition. And my worry is that that is not what we have now, that we have these companies that have grown so huge that they're exerting monopoly power, market concentration.
That policy agenda doesn't always resonate with conservative activists like Carl Bearden. He's the head of the group United for Missouri.
There's some good basis for things. He points out some good issues, but then when government's the solution, people really start to question that.
But for others, Hawley's reframing of economic issues could be the start of a new kind of populism for Republicans. Jeff Rowe is a Missouri-born political consultant who helped run Senator Ted Cruz's presidential campaign.
To make an impact in the world's most deliberative body, you've got to have a little gumption and be a little rambunctious.
Rowe also says that while some of Holly's proposals may not sit well with corporate CEOs, they do resonate with a big slice of the GOP base.
He certainly is stirring debate from his kind of trust-busting mentality that he has towards big business. That is a part of the Republican electorate that is active, it's energized.
Whether Holly's ideas, including his jobs proposal, will make it far is an open question. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and other prominent Republicans have balked at the idea of expensive new initiatives in the next phase of coronavirus legislation. Holly is unfazed.
We're not going to have an economy to open up if nobody has jobs. And my own view is, as we shift towards recovery, as we move towards economic recovery, our focus needs to be on jobs.
Holly added that the best case for ambitious proposals could be the tens of millions of people out of work, many of whom are looking for Congress to act. For NPR News, I'm Jason Rosenbaum in St. Louis.
President Trump is backing Tesla CEO Elon Musk in his feud with public health officials in California. Tesla started making cars again this weekend in defiance of public health guidelines, and Musk has filed a lawsuit against Alameda County, where the plant is located, and even threatened to move Tesla out of California in light of the coronavirus restrictions. For more, we're joined by Sean O'Kane. He's senior reporter at The Verge. Hi, Sean.
Thanks for having me.
So President Trump tweeted today, quote, "California should let Tesla and Elon Musk open the plant now. It can be done fast and safely." Musk has pointed out that auto manufacturers in other states are allowed to operate. What's his argument exactly?
Well, what's funny about the Trump tweet is that they're actually already open. I reported yesterday that Tesla was making cars over the weekend, even while Elon Musk had the company sue Alameda County. But, you know, his whole disagreement, Elon Musk's disagreement, really stems from Alameda County's stay-at-home order, which that's been about a month and a half now that the car factory in question, which is Tesla's only car factory in the United States, hasn't been able to make any product. And Tesla is, more than any other automaker, very reliant on the amount of cars it can make because it essentially has more demand than it has supply. And so every car that comes off the line there pretty much goes right out to a customer for all intents and purposes. And so they're very dependent on being able to keep production up and running. They don't have, you know, dealerships sitting with a bunch of product waiting to be bought. They need to deliver directly to consumers.
You've spoken to some Tesla workers. What are you hearing from them?
You know, it's really mixed, but mixed in a way that isn't typical for the employees that I've spoken to who work for the company in the past. You know, these people, the majority of the factory workers are hourly workers, so they really depend on their time at the factory to be able to bring home a paycheck. And they've been furloughed, and if not furloughed without pay, then with a pay cut over the last month. You know, one of them said very explicitly to me, and this is someone who has someone who is immunocompromised, you know, within their sort of personal orbit, said basically, you know, I'm going in because I need to put food on the table. Another person that I spoke to said they were staying home because they felt comfortable enough to be able to do that. And they felt like it was too risky to go in, even with some of the protective measures that Tesla has announced.
I want to ask you about the history of workplace safety violations. I mean, do you have any sense of what it's like on the line at Tesla right now? Are they complying with any of the social distancing requirements or providing protective equipment?
They've said, you know, they released this sort of packet over the weekend describing some of the protective measures that they're going to be put in place. It sort of remains to be seen. But yeah, I mean, I think something that's worth considering in the background of all of this is that Tesla's history with workplace safety is not very great. You know, patterns of people getting injured. They've gone as far as fighting letting OSHA come into the Gigafactory in Nevada, even when OSHA had a warrant and showed up to try to just investigate some injuries there. So it's very hard to get information from inside the company that isn't run through the company's filter, which complicates all of this.
And we should note that workers are not unionized. And Musk has said that they can take time off, but they won't be paid for it if they're fearful of going back to work. Will Tesla face any repercussions for this move?
it's really unclear. It does seem like from the text of the order that, you know, maybe the worst they could face are sort of fines. You know, as he tweeted yesterday and said that the factory was reopening, he said he'd be on the line and that he wants to be arrested if anyone is going to be arrested. So he's really put the ball in the court of the Fremont Police Department and the Alameda County Sheriff's Department, who, to their credit, say they're still working with Tesla on trying to figure out a plan for reopening.
Yeah. And in light of all of this, Tesla stock started this week with a rally. So very interesting stuff here. That's Sean O'Kane. He's senior reporter at The Verge. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Let's go to Michigan now, where auto plants are reopening with strict social distancing measures. They've been closed since March when the coronavirus outbreak began. And for more, we're joined by reporter Phoebe Wall Howard of the Detroit Free Press. Hi, Phoebe.
Hi.
So these are auto part supplier plants, not automakers like Ford and GM. We'll get to those openings in just a moment. However, these plants that are opening this week still impact hundreds of thousands of workers. What kind of precautions have the companies said they'll take?
Again, this is so important what you're spotlighting. For one reason is, of course, when people need auto repairs, that's one of the big issues, right? It's parts. So the safety right now is they're testing things with these early groups, temperature taking and hand washing and sanitizing, and how quickly they can get in and out. They're testing issues related to distance work and how people are coming and going and how to navigate that. So we're talking thousands and thousands of people will be coming and going, and the company is very concerned about safety.
You know, we've been talking quite a bit over the last few weeks about meatpacking plants, and workers from those plants have said they can't really social distance without actually slowing down the production line. I'm just wondering, is that the case for some of these auto part plants, and are they going to be operating at full speed?
The companies will not reveal the line speed at this time. However, there are just basic realities in terms of automotive production. You actually can't adjust certain things. So in exchange for that, they'll be having not just face masks on certain employees, but also face shields, the type of headgear that police officers and healthcare workers wear. They will be taking more breaks. They will be doing more to sterilize the immediate environment where social distancing simply isn't possible. But that is a concern with United Auto Workers. You've got folks who do want to come back to work, but the reality is you have to work hand-to-hand and face-to-face to get things. I like to remind people that, you know, a Ford F-150 pickup is built in less than a minute.
A couple of questions I have for you. Are workers talking at all about this publicly? Do workers feel safe going back?
Workers really fought to shut down the plants in March. We documented a situation where actually one of the Fiat Chrysler plants shut down because of conflict related to fear. One of the workers became sick on the line and became extremely ill. Other workers thought that it was consistent with the coronavirus symptoms, and people were so scared there was actually almost a physical altercation between workers and management trying to calm people. So that fear then is very real. Workers know people who have died after the COVID diagnosis in both Ford and Fiat Chrysler. So they also have a lot of workers with multiple generations in the home with multiple health conditions. So this is a little bit more complicated.
Yeah. You mentioned the United Auto Workers Union. They've played a big part in this delay. As you mentioned, workers are part of the union. But what about the plan for the big three automakers? You mentioned next week is when they plan to open, and there's a reason for that delay.
Yeah, what's quite fascinating is that the UAW leaders and the Detroit Three have been meeting almost daily to coordinate this reopen. So this week is the slow open, May 18th. The other plants are opening all over the country. And then the following week, the 25th, will be the final push. But the union leaders actually have played a key role in educating members what to expect with thermal imaging when you arrive at the factory. new installed turnstiles to navigate different entrances so people can be monitored. One of the big concerns is that if someone tests positive, tracking who they've been in contact with so that those folks can be quarantined. Oh. This is a highly technical return to work.
Yeah. These companies are major employers for that region. How much will the opening impact the struggling economy there in Michigan?
Oh, I think the impact of the return for the auto industry writ large is significant. Obviously, we also depend on the Mexico suppliers. The ties between Detroit and Mexico and the U.S. and Mexico with parts going back and forth. So we're also watching what the virus is doing down in Mexico and hoping that doesn't slow the reopen in the U.S. But in North America, for Ford alone, you know, we're talking about more than 70,000 people returning to work next week. It's a lot of people all at once.
That's Phoebe Wall Howard of the Detroit Free Press. Phoebe, thank you so much.
Thank you. Such a pleasure.
The coronavirus pandemic has a lot of us doing a lot more cooking, but maybe you, like me, feel like you're making the same recipes over and over, and maybe it's time to move to level two, which is why we are bringing in Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst with some ideas. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Jeremy.
And I must say, it is kind of hard to come up with ways to make what you're cooking more interesting after all these weeks.
Yeah, I mean, we're a few months into this, and I keep hearing from people that, just as you said, their kitchen skills are truly being tested, and people are sort of craving new flavors. We're into a new season. It's, you know, we're having warmer days and cold nights on the East Coast still. The West Coast is in a heat wave. So what do you cook? How do you brighten the flavors of your everyday cooking without spending a lot more time at the grocery store, which is problematic, and without spending a lot of money, which is also problematic as so many people are out of work? So I've heard from all kinds of people saying, I'm so bored, I'm going nuts with my food. Help. So that's what we're going to talk about.
Well, and you have a suggestion for a simple pasta dish using lemon.
I do. So it's called spaghetti al limone, which is a lot sexier than saying spaghetti with lemon. This is an Italian dish, and it's the sophistication of the dish kind of belies its simple ingredients. It is pantry cooking at its best. You boil a pot of salted water, and you throw in some spaghetti and linguine. And then in a large skillet, you saute some garlic, lemon zest and lemon juice. And then this is really the catch. You add some of the salted pasta water that you're cooking the pasta in, and that becomes the basis of the sauce. You drain your pasta while it's still al dente, throw it into this lemony, watery, delicious sauce, some grated Parmesan, and you have got an incredibly bright spring fresh flavored pasta dish that really uses four ingredients. So here, lemon, a very common ingredient, brightens up pasta, which a lot of people are living on and sick of. So this gives it kind of a new seasonal twist.
I have to say that one of the things at the supermarket that I've been buying so much of are lemons and limes, and getting through a lot of them, although not all with pasta, Kathy. Sometimes it is for a gin and tonic. But let's talk about another.
I had a feeling you were going to go there.
Well, let's talk about another recipe you've brought us, which is a soup, a spring green soup.
Yeah, we're kind of in this segue season here in New England. As I said, it's still really cold at night. I've been making a lot of soups. One I call a spring green soup. And this uses fresh, or you might not believe it, frozen greens. That we're starting to see asparagus and spring beet greens and mustard greens and spinach. And this is a soup where you saute an onion, maybe you have a shallot or a leek, and then you throw in spinach, beet greens, kale, Swiss chard, asparagus, whatever you have. And again, it could be a box of frozen spinach. No judgment, it'll be great. I add a little bit of a potato. I have some celery root around, which is also called celeriac. I add some vegetarian vegetarian or chicken stock, whirl it up, and it's this instant green soup that is very energized and, again, fresh tasting and feels like not a winter soup, but really like an honor to this new season. A little dollop of Greek yogurt on top, and you're there.
You mentioned frozen vegetables. I must say that they're not in high supply at my local supermarket. But let's talk about your next soup, which is a spring miso broth with greens and ginger meatballs. Again, we've been hearing that meat is not always easy to come by. What would you suggest?
Exactly. If you don't have access to good meat, you could certainly add tofu. But in this case, I take a box chicken stock or a vegetarian stock. I add ginger and garlic and miso paste, let it get kind of thick, a little soy sauce, sesame oil. And then again, I throw in spring greens and bits of asparagus. And I make these little tiny bite-sized meatballs out of ground meat and or pork, flavored with a ton of fresh ginger. And the meatballs are brown, so they're crunchy on the outside. And then they're simmered in this broth. And then you can add ramen noodles or udon noodles. And it's really a very hearty, delicious soup in one bowl, and full of fresh spring flavors, and kind of takes soup into a new realm with these tiny meatballs. I am a big fan of this soup.
All right. Well, we're going to post all of these at hereandnow.org. Kathy, I will say that we've been coming up with a menu every day to try to keep things interesting. Although every Friday is Pizza Friday, and I have made your clam pizza, which is absolutely delicious.
Nice,
as well.
Nice.
And every Tuesday now is Martes Mexicano, so we can make something Mexican on Tuesday. That's today. Kathy Gunst, Here and Now resident chef. Again, we've got all these recipes at hereandnow.org. Kathy, thanks as always.
Great to talk to you. Take care.
Tanya, you making anything good in the kitchen?
Oh my gosh, she just helped me out so much because I'm so boring when it comes to pasta. So I'm taking her recipe for sure with lemon.
Spaghetti al limone. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.